Hello and welcome back to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Tina Quinn. It's good to have your company. This week we're taking a look behind the scenes, or lines if you will, of a very specific arm of the media, that of cartoonists. While many journalists or columnists need inches upon inches to get their audience to the crux of an issue, the social and political commentary of a cartoonist has the power to do so within one frame. This, however, doesn't make the job any easier. Their work has to provide their audience with not only short and sharp analysis of the issue, but combine their illustrative talent with a hopefully well-developed sense for satire. Joining us on the panel are two giants of the genre. Kathy Wilcox, she's been churning out political cartoons for both The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald since 1989. Her work has won her numerous Walkleys, and she's also published two collections of her cartoons, as well as illustrated numerous children's books. She joins us from her home in Sydney. Kathy Wilcox, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Hi, Tina. Good to be here.
And First Dog on the Moon, another Walkley Award winner. His work first came to prominence more than a decade ago working for Crikey. Since 2014, he's been the regular political cartoonist for Guardian Australia. He joins us now from his very mysterious bolt hole, which is located somewhere in the woods of Tasmania. First Dog, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you on. Now, jumping right in, there's a series of pretty standard pathways to becoming a journalist, but becoming a cartoonist isn't quite as straightforward. I'd be interested to hear how both of you became cartoonists and whether there was a specific moment when you thought, you know, this is what I want to be. Kathy, do you first?
I don't think there was a really clear moment of going, this is that I want to be a cartoonist.
Because it's not something you look at when you're 16 and kind of go, you know, oh, that's what I want to do. You know, that's not
No, it was much more subconscious. It was much more gravitational than a conscious decision. Although I have made many conscious decisions in my life, you know, towards this career. But it was more the thing of gradually realizing that the drawing with the words thing was what I like to do most. Mm-hmm. I like to do the drawing, but I still like the words part. I like the funny part. I, you know, grew up looking for the cartoons and comics in the paper, and you know, my dad kind of lit that little flame very early on in my life of just sort of, you know, reading me the comics and stuff. And I also felt very comfortable with the newspaper as a format. I like the newspaper as this sort of daily place where the story changes and evolves and so on, and I pictured myself doing some work in the newspaper. I pictured myself, you know, I kind of thought, oh, I'd like to be filling those spaces.
So you could see yourself in the media then?
So I could see myself, yeah, working with the daily supply of new stuff. And I think in sort of subsequent years, looking at that is also the sort of the short attention span thing.
Right.
The daily stuff changes because on working on long projects about on the same topic, I could easily get bored. And then being given these little spaces to fill, gradually the style kind of formed itself and it reinforced itself such that this became, you know, from gag cartoons to the occasional political social thing to purely the political social stuff to, you know, from the small little spaces to the bigger spaces when other people would go on holidays or die or go on leave or whatever. And then that sort of gradually...
They never die.
Well,
they
yeah,
never
that,
die.
An ailing cartoonist back at the age was really one of my best opportunities, I have to say.
you sort of hitched your horse to his wagon.
Well, it just provided the opportunity, and it was also the like it's not an easy thing to step into out of nothing when you're used to just doing maybe small cartoons and someone says, oh, can you do the editorial cartoon? It's a very different gig. And this person at the time would occasionally call in sick, or his daughter would call in for him sick. And, you know, he had a series of illnesses and stuff like that. So I was often being asked to do this at short notice. And so I must have managed to do it at short notice, which is not an easy thing to do. That's kind of how I got into it. It just, the more I did it, the more it was what I liked to do and the less I wanted to do other things.
What about you, First Dog?
Well, I always wanted to be an actor. And being a cartoonist was my backup plan. And I came to it much later. I'd always liked drawing and being funny and clever. very happy to entertain myself. But I could never convince the editors of any of the major publications to take me on. And for that very reason, it was people like Kathy Wilcox were stepping up. And once, I mean, why would you give up being a cartoonist? So once they had their cartoonists, that was it. The opportunities really just didn't pop up unless one of them got run over or became simply too old, and that rarely happened. So it was much later in life for me to finally get, not that much later, but to finally get a crack at Crikey, who took me on. And then once you're established as a full-time cartoonist, I think you're probably pretty hard to get rid of.
You both mentioned that,
like,
yeah.
Like a fungus.
Like some sort of weird stain that will not scrub out. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to end up at The Guardian. I'm hopeful that they'll never get rid of me. The media is a very, very different landscape, you know, which is not a surprise to anyone than it was, say, 20, even 10 years ago. And I mean, you know, and to anybody who these days is looking to become a cartoonist, I'd be discouraging them.
Right.
But that hasn't changed. Being a cartoonist it's not a real job. The worst thing about being a cartoonist is other cartoonists, and except Kathy, of course. And it's can be diabolical, but it's really, really hard to land something like a full-time job as a cartoonist. And
so you started, you started with Crikey, and then you've gone on obviously to The Guardian. And Kathy, you've always been with Fairfax.
Yeah. And also I'd say that like there's even a 10 year difference between my start and First Dogs in, you know, trying to get a break, because when I started out, there was money for taking on contributors, and there was money for new people to walk in and get a shot, you know, here, you know, you can do a cartoon for The Guide or the good food section or the whatever, you know, you could walk in and talk to the editors. And editors of different sections had discretionary budget to spend on cartoonists. And I had already spent a few years in Paris. When I finished my studies at Sydney College of the Arts, I went to Paris on a, you know, stupid, idiotic, youthful whim to find my place in the world. And while I was there, I did get some illustration work with some magazines. But I already kind of felt that I wanted to draw for newspapers. And so I was taking my little portfolio around to newspapers there. And at that point I was being told, well, we already have our Plantu, or we already have our, you know, whoever it was at the Libération. And that is what it then became in Sydney, sort of, you know, 10, 15 years later, you know, by 10 or 15 years later, those shifting opportunities sort of dried up, because there were already sort of rounds of budget cuts and such, so that people didn't have discretion to just sort of spend them on, you know, all right, well, let's get a few more cartoons in, or, oh yeah, we need another one to, you know, to fill the space. So those, you know, there was sort of a golden decade there where cartoonists actually would increase their salary considerably by being poached by another newspaper. And
it's true. We talk of in whispered tones of the golden age, when cartoonists were on hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dollars and were sort of revered as these, you know, these mysterious honored figures. And now, I mean, I think it's probably a bit strong to say we're held widely in contempt by the community, but we're certainly paid as if we are.
Right. Okay.
We're not told, you know, what name your price. That's for sure. And at certain newspapers, you know, people have been told, well, look, you know, we'd like to keep you on, except that you're too expensive. So I'm sorry, you can, there's the door. So, right. So that's, you know, that's what it is now, you know, so very big difference to how it was 20 or 30 years ago.
So growing up, Kathy, you mentioned that your father always used to sort of bring you over and he'd have his newspaper and he was always pointing you in the direction of cartoons, and that's sort of something that you did together. What work spoke to you back then when you were growing up? What cartoonists?
Well, the stuff that my dad pointed me to was when I was really little, he'd be reading me the Sunday comics, and so the mm-hmm. Peanuts comics in particular. Yeah. And if, you know, I liked the funnies. I looked at the other ones, those sort of adventure strips of Mandrake and mm-hmm. so on for the drawing. I didn't read
those. Prince Valiant.
Prince Valiant, that's right. I was fascinated at those jawlines and amazing pectoral muscles and things like that. You know, I would look at how they were drawn. And mm-hmm. so I was, because I just loved drawing from drawing people. But for the funnies, then I probably, you know, gravitated to whoever were the cartoonists in the newspapers that we had. So there would have been Benia and Molnar in the very early years when I was still pretty small. Mm-hmm. Patrick Cook, Jenny Coops, the cartoonists who were of the era just prior to me too, the ones who were in the National Times and so on. And then by the time I was at art college, then everybody was emulating Lunig, funnily enough.
Yes, Michael, the great Michael Lunig.
I wouldn't admit it now, but we all were emulating. You know, he was something that was really different to the previous standard type of political cartoon or editorial cartoon. And also I began to look overseas sort of through the time of my being at art college and then going overseas. There were some French cartoonists whose work I loved, and some of the American illustrators, the illustrators whose work appeared in the New Yorker and such, and Sompei, so you know, once you sort of have a bit of a taste for the medium, then as you get older, you start to sort of hunt out other stuff. But yeah, so it was always the single frame or the political or social stuff that interested me more than the long form comic strip or graphic novel version.
I mean, Lunig always comes up in these conversations. And when he started in the Nation Review, there really wasn't anyone else like him. Mm. And that was the 70s, and it was a different time, as they say.
Well, there was no other paper really like the Nation Review, really.
No, there wasn't. And look, he was fantastic, and he really made he had a real impact on Tiny First Dog back in the day, because I mean I read Peanuts and Hey Gal.
Were you first puppy back then?
maybe.
Sorry,
I'm not
bad
sure.
Joke.
I probably wasn't the first dog.
Adorable. I loved it.
Yes. No, I was a marvelous child. I was lonely and weird, but that's another story for another time. But so you'd read Hagar the Horrible and Donald Duck and Spider-Man and Michael Lunig.
Yeah.
And it was quite a combination. And Bruce Petty, I think, probably a big influence. He was the ideas, his wonderful chaos that was, you know, easily identifiable as this terrible machine or this politician and these ridiculous squiggly lines that couldn't ever form anything useful, and they were just the most wonderful cartoons.
So it sounds like you both it sounds like you both had a real appetite for cartoons. So it was something that you were able to identify from quite a young age that obviously had an influence on you both. Moving on a little bit, while the news media seems to be losing, you know, quite a lot of power and influence, cartoons still seem to have held on to their power. You know, for starters, they're very shareable on social media. A good cartoon it's not just satire, not just a joke. A good cartoon can really pass comment or even sometimes clarify complex issues. Now, often cartoonists can say what people are thinking, but they, you know, feel uncomfortable to say out loud. How do you view a good cartoon, and do you feel they still carry power? Kathy, do you?
Yes, they do carry power, and I always think that the proof that they carry power is that there are countries and regimes where removing the cartoonists from currency is kind of one of the main things that the powerful would want to do. We live in a society where most people can read the caption and read the story and stuff, but in societies where there might be a lot of people who are deprived of an education, to be literate, then they can read a cartoon, and especially if it's not a wordy one like First Dogs or Mine, they can read a cartoon and have a sense of what's going on, and have a sense that it's not the same as what the leaders are saying. Mm. And so cartoonists are powerful and dangerous in that way. Mm. In various places and in places around the world they are endangered because they're troublesome. And then even in democracies, through the Trump years, there were very many newspapers and publications that got rid of their cartoonists or started to tell their cartoonists not to do so many anti-Trump cartoons because right. they were getting blowback on that. So that kind of showed that the ultimate thing that a cartoonist can do is ridicule the powerful.
Right.
And once the powerful are ridiculous, they cease to have power. That's the thing that cartoonists do. That's the power that cartoonists do have. But at the same time, people consume cartoons without necessarily understanding that. So they right. kind of they want to be able to see the cartoons, but they kind of don't appreciate the structure that is required to keep a cartoonist going. Mm. So they would like to be able to have the cartoons to share, to say, oh, look at this one, but they're not going, okay, somebody actually had to live in the circumstances to be able to produce that work, and as well they need to be able to be supported to mm-hmm. do that. First Dog could perhaps speak of somebody like Eaton Fish on that matter.
Yeah, I could. I mean, Kathy always gives better answers to that question than I do, because I'm a little more cynical. I take the Peter Cook view of satire, that all those cabarets in pre-war Berlin put a stop to the Third Reich. But it is absolutely true that
I admit that we fail. Perfectly free to admit that we fail to change anything.
No, but your point about cartoonists being in danger around the world is a good one, and the changing nature of the media is. I blame. I've got a long list of people I blame, the cartoonists certainly aren't at the top of that list. And I hide down here in my little foresty enclave in Tasmania and produce my snide, unpleasant, overly wordy cartoons, and people seem to really enjoy them, which is fantastic. And I try to educate, and I try to do all those terrible things like amplify voices and all that sort of stuff, so take a sort of a more activist view of it. But I think cartooning, like any, I mean, it can be as progressive and as important or as reactionary and dangerous as any art form, really. It just has that capacity to punch through, and most cartoonists other than me have the capacity to do it in a single frame. And so to puncture that pomposity, and to upset people who are in power is great. It's not the main game. It's always seemed to me very much the jester in the king's court,
I find it really interesting that you've just referred to yourself as an activist, because that's something that, from the word go, as soon as we enter the field, journalists are told, you're not an activist, you're not here to advocate for the issue, you're here to report the facts and tell the story in a very balanced way. But I have to admit, when I do really look at the work of a lot of cartoonists and a lot of political cartoonists, there does seem to be a bit of a sense of activism within the work. What about yourself, Kathy? What do you consider yourself? Do you consider yourself an activist or an advocate, or are you a storyteller in the more traditional journalistic sense?
Well, I suppose I'm like an opinion writer in a way.
Right.
So I'm not there at the reporting level, saying that here's what's happened and let's hear from this person and then let's hear from their counterpart on the other side or whatever. I'm not engaged in any kind of both sides exercise, but I am attempting to sort of to come at things from a, not from a partisan position, but from a first principles approach, such that I want to try and understand. I can't help myself but see things from many sides. And so being diehard and having as the prism, you know, I don't want to see things through one prism of saying, well, these guys are the good guys and so mm-hmm. I will always barrack for them or whatever. And you know, First Dog would probably agree with me there. You know, you can be kind of activist on issues, but as soon as you start cheering for particular teams, that becomes kind of pointless because you're as bad as this, you know, as bad as the political stooges that you're maybe wanting to criticize.
Right.
So I don't join a party. I don't want my my stuff used. You know, when people from parties say, "Can we use your cartoon on our poster for blah 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 blah?" I say, "Is it you know political partisan or is it party political?" No, you can't use my stuff there. If it's an issue that I care about in particular, you know, that I have some sense of personal investment in, like, you know, I care about the treatment of refugees and so forth. And so there's a refugee advocacy group, then I might lend my work to that. But I don't see that. I refuse to see that as a partisan political thing. I think everything now, we're living in a time, you know, how was it put by those juice media people? You know, everything, they turn everything to shit. The government and the politicians, they turn everything to shit. And through this period of conservative government and through also the period of the Republican Trump presidency and so forth, they've been so successful at politicizing everything such that if you say, you know, stand up for one thing, you'll be tarred as being, oh, well, you'd say that because you're from this group or that group. And I just refuse. I just think that's a wicked, wicked game that is being played there. And I kind of won't play it. The politicization of, you know, of climate, of vaccinations and masks and provision of education and all these sorts of things. It's so damaging. And so I want to get underneath that and go, no, I still want to talk about the issue, not the whether somebody is, you know, whether saying that is a Liberal position or a Labor position or a Greens position or whatever. I'm really not that interested in the party view of things. But I do, you know, and I don't hold back, though, on pointing to the person who is responsible for stuff. And I think that's where, you know, if my dad might say, oh, you've been going a bit hard on Scott Morrison lately, because my dad is my parents were conservative voting, you know, North Shore blue tie wearing sort of, you know, I grew up in a conservative household of you know, men's men and conformity and so forth. So I understand that mentality a great deal. So, yeah, I sort of think, well, I'm too bad if I'm going hard on the guy who he himself claimed that role of responsibility so he can jolly well be responsible.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, I think when they take aim at certain wings of the media or certain arms of the media who do try and hold the federal government to account and say, oh, well, you're not going after the other side enough. The other side aren't in power. So it's, you know, it's the media's job to hold power to account. So, and it would be the same. And, you know, the same discussions were being had 10 years ago when we had a Labor government. So First Dog, you know, as Kathy's just mentioned, I mean, the last 4 years have been an intense time to be a cartoonist from, you know, the material is endless. You've got Trump, you've got the ascent of Scott Morrison, COVID-19. You've never been short of material. How do you approach each cartoon and do you have rules on how you pick your subject?
Well, I usually have a conversation with my editors about what people want to read, which is one of the things that we give consideration to. You know, at the moment, people are reading a lot about COVID and vaccines, funnily enough, because people have a lot of feelings about those things, feelings and opinions. So we talk about those things. And I mean, look, I take a slightly different view of the politics of the thing. I don't think we can be outside of the politics of any situation. And while when it comes to humans, I don't choose particular teams. Certainly when it comes to, you know, furry animals and seabirds, I'm very much on their side and will always take their side. So that is in essence a partisan position. And I do, I have to disagree slightly with Kathy that I think that the whole, and I understand where she's coming from, and that you can't just sort of wander around saying, I agree with these people and I disagree with those people outside of the actual work of the cartooning that you do, because you leave yourself open to criticisms of bias, which again, I don't think is a real thing, but I understand that's kind of the environment we operate in. Whereas I just go, yeah, you can all get nicked. And because I do have opinions, and some people are Nazis and some people aren't, and I'll make fun of the Nazis and the people who aren't, well, we'll see how they go. What's important to me is that we don't sort of celebrate this idea that with Trump, the whole both sidesism thing was a really stark example of, well, you know, there are good people on that side and there are good people on this side. And there simply weren't. In choosing not to take a position on something, you're choosing to take a position. And I think you can look at any of the media reporting over the years on something, even like, you know, First Nations people in Australia and how they were previously reported on and how it's reported on now. And I think what's happened is that because, and it's partly the fault of Facebook and Twitter in a good way, in that everybody gets to have their say now, and the media's had to come to terms with how they're going to deal with that. And more importantly, the right has had to come to terms with how they're going to deal with that. And clearly, the right, I think, was going to lose control of all of these conversations because all of these people were getting together and going, hey, wait a minute, climate change is bad and racism is bad and we need to do something about all of this and become a popular mass movement, which is the only way we're really going to save the planet.
Mm.
And so the right, who own everything, because it's capitalism, thank you, have gone, well, we can't control the conversation, so we're just going to blow it up. And that's what Trump was. That's what Bannon talking about, flooding the floor with shit. So basically, that's where the whole fake news thing comes from. So truth suddenly becomes irrelevant. And suddenly we have fake news. Suddenly everybody's got their own sets of facts. Mm. So when, as a journalist, you're going to say, well, I'm just going to tell the truth, and I'm only going to tell, you know, what's really happening, that's, you might be doing that, but you're still doing it from your perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's because I remember, 15 years ago, 10 years ago when I started as a cartoonist, I was like, no, we have to make sure that facts are what's always reported. And whenever somebody says something that's untrue in government, we need to refute it, and we need these fact-checking things like, you know, ABC fact check and all stuff, which I have to say I came up with before the ABC did, but I couldn't get Crikey to build a fact-checking unit anyway.
Right.
And so now
you were it.
Exactly. And now what happens is it's left to the cartoonist, and as soon as anything's left to the cartoonist, we're doomed. But now the government says whatever they simply like. And the media can stand up and say, well, actually, that's not true. Or they can be like the Murdoch media and go and just simply not report that it's garbage. And nobody trusts anything anymore. And so they get to do, they being the government and the people in power, get to do pretty much whatever they like. So they're winning. You know, they've done a great job. And with all due respect to cartoonists, people shouldn't be looking to cartoonists to help guide us through these difficult times, because it's only going to end in a lot of tears. There, that's a much better answer.
Well, okay. Well, on that sobering thought, look, Kathy, the media in general has a diversity problem, but cartooning, if you don't mind me saying, is even less diverse than the average newsroom. And, you know, and not just diversity, it really is a bloke's world. Does it worry you, and do you see a new generation of cartoonists coming along? I mean, you're one of the very few prominent female cartoonists within Australia that I can think of, at least. How do you feel about it when you looking at it through the lens of diversity?
Well, I think that the conversation of diversity has definitely moved on, and diversity, when I was beginning, we were thinking that diversity was getting more women cartoonists, You know, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, great. Oh, well, now there are some women cartoonists doing it. And there was Victoria Roberts, who went to the States. And there was Kaz Cook, who, you know, decided that doing cartoons, you know, regularly was not actually, even though for the short amount of time that she was a cartoonist, she was still always known, she is still always known as the cartoonist Kaz Cook. Mm-hmm. Jenny Coops, who had a fine career and who was really one of my kind of role models when I sort of stepped in. She also, you know, a chance meeting gave me one of my first opportunities with her. Judy Horacek, who was contemporary of mine when we were both beginning, but I saw myself as quite different to her in that there was the tendency at the time was to say if you're a woman cartoonist then you need to be writing about women's things all the time and women's issues and I rejected that limitation at the time and I've always said no, I want to be able to talk about all things and I don't want to always put them through the same prism. Having said that, then my life experiences inform my work and so on. So when I come now to say something about what's going on, you know, when there's some, you know, issues of say how women are treated in Parliament and so forth, I can, you know, come at it from a strong women's perspective and more usefully so, because it's not just, well, she would say that she's a feminist sort of thing. It's like, I think that there's some grounding in that. But the number of women cartoonists has not increased. In fact, it's, you know, it's been harder and harder for any woman to get a gig in it.
Mm.
Fiona Katauskas has been there for like 20 out of 30 of the years that I've been drawing, and she has, you know, she has struggled to get a prominent, regular, you know, mainstream, or, you know, she hasn't necessarily chosen mainstream, but she has struggled to get a gig such that she could live from it. So on the one hand, I think, you know, this like trying for diversity when that was the pure goal was gender diversity, it was like on a hiding to nothing.
Mm.
Like it was not gonna happen because of the aforementioned point of a first dog that cartoonists don't leave, they don't retire, they die eventually, but they don't step down willingly, and cartoon positions have shrunk considerably.
Right.
You know, there's far fewer of us now filling the available spaces and spread thinly. So we didn't even get to the point of saying, what about the diversity of people from other cultures? What about our First Nations? What about, you know, these other perspectives? What about trans people and all the rest of it? These other perspectives have certainly not ever got a run in mainstream media, you know, and I see myself as, in spite of being a woman doing the job, I'm still very, you know, mainstream probably in the whole thing and privileged and all the rest of it. I'm only, you know, it's only a, I can only play the woman card if I really choose to in terms of saying there's a mark of diversity there, but basically I, you know, I just did the job and so on. But the thing is, of those diverse voices, at least they come up elsewhere, and I have often seen that the parallel career of comedy and satire, where, you know, where people start off doing stand-up and then, you know, evolve other sorts of things, at least that has evolved, and women's voices are as usual to be found there, and diversity of color and culture and sexuality and so forth have grown up there. So that's maybe where it is, and it's, you know, maybe where cartooning in the form in which I practice it will be coming to an end in this country, at least. You know, it still seems to happen around the world, and other people are getting the idea, but we've just got such a small arena for it here, it seems. But people still have things to say, and young people grow up, you know, with the notion that cartooning is a kind of communication that gets things across. And if First Dog says that he went to Sydney College of the Arts, as did I, then we know that that our education there was about communication and visual communication and getting things across. So I don't therefore think that cartooning is the only format. Already First Dog's way of doing it is a very different way than the old, you know, newspaper single frame type of thing. And the people who put stuff up on, you know, and have their sites on the internet, Lord knows how they make a living out of it, but they're better, the younger people are better at doing it than we old dinosaurs. But people find a way to speak and to get messages across and to find an audience hungry for an antidote to the sort of bullshit that they're otherwise fed.
Well, look, we are just out of time, but First Dog, if you have anything to add to that in about 60 seconds.
Oh, well, look, Cathy's right. Sorry. It comes back to, it's a newsroom thing. The cartoonist hire is done in the newsroom, and it's usually done by the old blokey news editor. Mm-hmm. And you know, the media, for all of the newfangled internet blah, 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 mm-hmm. is still focused mm-hmm. on, it's still very old school. And there are a great many more avenues for different voices. Terrible phrase, but you know, I look at someone like Larry Harris who edits The Nib, and who, you know, and that's a comic magazine mm-hmm. compendium that comes out of the US, and that's jam-packed full of all sorts of different cartoonists from different backgrounds who aren't just cartooning about the backgrounds they come from, they're just being cartoonists. And I think that's also an important thing. But for me, it's I'm hardly a it's very kind of Cathy to mention that. I mean, I do a very different thing to the mm-hmm. traditional mm-hmm. cartoonist. I don't, you know, because I go on and on and I do frames and frames, and I don't think I'm a diversity hire, but I mean well, and I think that's what's important.
I think so too. I think you both do. Cathy Wilcox, thank you so much for joining us on Fourth Estate.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tina.
And First Dog on the Moon, thank you very much as well for being on Fourth Estate. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. It was an absolute hoot.
And thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Big thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, do stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Many thanks as always to my executive producer, Anthony Dockrill. My name's Tina Quinn. Please stay well, and you can catch us next week on Fourth Estate.